The only question I had was about the cloud.
The cloud. All right, I'm your
The
man.
cloud. And I know there is an answer to this because this is such a kind of meta question. Because I think of the kind of Wardley style S curve of innovation going up to commoditization. And I think, well, apart from Hello Michael, blah, blah, blah. And then I think in the olden days, we would have FTP and you'd have a slice of someone else's server and you'd FTP your HTML files up onto that. And if you didn't like that FTP server, you could buy some FTP server from someone else because it was a commodity, it's an open standard. And now I've been faffing about with AWS Lambda and the Azure function stuff, and they're great and they do everything for me and they are sort of a commodity, but isn't that just lock-in? I mean, I can't take my AWS Lambda thing and just put it in Azure. So this is the thing I'm trying to get my head around because Simon Wardley keeps going on about commoditization and his big thing about electricity and all that sort of stuff. Where's the commoditization here? It seems like the opposite of it.
Man, there's a lot going on there. First of all, I need to read that Simon Wardley stuff because I don't really know what he's talking about. You got to have maps. That's fine. It seems like there's a lot of intelligence going on there that's very handy, but it's not how I learned to do strategy, which I think is fine. But that's fine. That's fine. I think there's something going on there that looks handy. Someone else, I think he has a bunch of chapters written in Medium, because speaking of servers, that's the modern day FTP server for HTML, I think. And but then someone else wrote a book about his maps, which that probably is one of the better ways to consume it. I think maybe if I could get someone to write a book about all my nonsense, it would probably be much better written. That would be great. So,
Have you thought of ghostwriting yourself?
I like that. That's
I
good.
did not write this book. I mean, that would be really good. It's like calling yourself, George Eliot. It's like I'm T.S. Eliot, George Eliot. I'm on some pills. I have an excuse for all of this. It's like giving yourself a new name, and then you can pitch it like, "Hey, I've read this person's blog post. They're just brilliant. Tell you what, I'll just type them out for you, and you can print them.
I like
Wow, this guy is amazing. Who said it was a guy? It could be anybody."
it's a them, what is it? You got he, her, and then just them, and then don't you put an X in front of it at some point? I think that's I'm on that. I discovered this. I'll get back to your cloud lock-in. I've written that down on my iPad Pro. I came across. Have you come across this Jordan Peterson character? I don't. There was some. I use Nuzzle, and someone had linked to an Esquire, and that should be your. I used to subscribe to Esquire. I don't know why. Anyways, man, what a raucous ride that guy seems to be. Or actually, the opposite of a raucous ride. But it's strange, strange stuff.
The name
Or
rings a
not.
bell,
I don't
and
know.
I should remember, but please tell me of his latest work.
I think the whole premise is you remember he's like the modern day contemporaneous actually means in the past, right? Like it was contemporaneous to the time. Like you never would use the word contemporaneous and say it's contemporaneous to right now. So contemporaneous only gets used to describe the past, which is not contemporary. So I think the English language has yet another thing to answer for. Anyhow, I think it's the contemporary example of everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten, and and then also the hit follow-up, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And I'm probably belittling it without actually having written it,
You
which I think
certainly
is
sound
what
like you
most
are.
critics of this guy do. But I think it's basically it's. I think it's one of those things of like you should be a you should have more traditional thoughts about being happy about yourself that are not religious. So it's all, stand up straight, guy? Be proud of yourself.
Oh, yes,
the rules guy.
Faint suggestion.
And this came to mind because... And so this came to mind because my my understanding is that he became infamous, to use that word nuancedly, because he had suggested that deviating from the regular pronouns of English was bad or silly or something.
Right, I see.
So I don't know. It doesn't really. I mean, I feel like I don't know if he is an atheist. I just read this that he doesn't have God stuff, but I feel like if you're bold enough to like strike the Sky Lord out of the sky, it's just like, you know, whatever. If someone wants to call themselves them, it's cool. Like it's fine, right? You don't.
It does seem to be fine. Yeah.
Worry about it, but you know, I think standing up straight. I've been working on that too. The got to work on the posture before my body falls apart. But speaking of your body falling apart, we probably listen to the same podcast where they complain about that, and you're like, Jesus Christ, I'm gonna fall apart like that old piece of rubber in my grandpa's attic from like the 30s, and you pick it up and it just disintegrates. Cloud lock in. That's
just a moment. I've got to stop you on there first because we're not going to circle back to anything. You know, we never circle back to anything. Talking about body falling apart, it was recently I share a birthday with Dave Weiner, which means I am 46, recently 46, and as a present to myself, I got myself an intensive no, it wasn't intensive, a week of yoga. So every day. Yeah, exactly. Every day, an hour and a half of yoga. And now I'm only going once a week. But I felt like I was injuring myself every day. It was very painful. Mm. So I'm going back.
Ah.
So it was awful. It was awful.
Yeah.
I feel bad about it.
What is the deal with that? I was describing to... I was describing to Kim once that recently that I want to figure out some kind of like low impact exercise that I can get into because I don't like doing exercising. And she was like, well, you know, there's always those old people who use chairs that you could exercise like. Yeah, do you have that in your culture?
Only in hospitals.
The old people with chairs.
Rest homes?
Maybe swimming. I feel like swimming is what I need.
Yeah. Can you swim?
I mean, I can swim as in not drown, but I don't know if
I reckon you spend quite a lot of time in hotels with swimming bars, swimming pools in them.
This is really nice.
So I bet you could, I mean, it'll be quite easy to fit in with something else you're doing. And you sound kind of cool as well, because people would say, you know, can you meet me at 10 o'clock? And you'd say, I'm just going to come back from my swim. Hey, swim? That sounds cool.
Hey, nice.
Yeah.
I thought you're going to use this as you're going to give me a tool that would allow me to just say no.
That would be a good, you could do the same thing. You could use the same thing. You could say, are you going to come to our round table about cloud something? I'd love to, but I'm going to be doing 600 lengths in the pool. So yeah, it'll be served both purposes.
That's right. The pool is only open exactly at that hour, so I can't come to your cloud lock and round table. And also, this table is not round. I'm out.
Yes, exactly.
Oh yeah. So it sounds like you would recommend yoga? By the fact that you're going to it again, is it a thing?
I honestly do find it useful, but that's like saying I don't know, anything painful and good for you is useful. I mean, it's all terrible. After 40 years old, you have to think. Most people have to think about healthcare, and healthcare after 40, however you do it, is money. So I'm really enjoying going to a place where most of the other people there are not the same gender as me and half my age. And they don't exactly laugh, but they are able to do things very easily that I am not able to do at all. And they help me. I mean, I get lots of help, which is nice.
Well, I have two follow-up questions or topics. One of which is in our topic blast for this week. So this is very exciting. Mm-hmm. Although I see that you typed into our show notes because Robert wants to talk more. So I'll try to not talk too much. First follow-up question.
That's not what Senator, that means. That's not what that means. it's because we need to spend longer on each topic.
Oh, good. You want to add more nuance.
Yes,
everything.
Yes.
It's not zero sum. It's not zero sum. So my first topic is, so in thinking about exercising, what strikes me is that it's usually around, if not worth, with other people. And yes. And I feel like that is, I don't know if this is a made up impediment or whatever, but I just like, I don't know how to exercise, right? Mm. And I know I could hire a personal trainer, but I don't want to be around people. Maybe if it was a robot. This is a good thought exercise. Like, would I be comfortable with a robot? Because it really is like the human judging aspect. Because a robot, one would assume, well, at least I would program it so it wouldn't judge, right? I mean, I wouldn't program it, but I'd ask it to be a non-judgmental robot. And it's just, I feel like this is a barrier to my health is you just have to either have someone teach you something or you've got to like be in a class with other people, let alone like go to a gym around people. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know what to do about that. Once again, this is maybe why swimming is a good idea. Cause swimming I feel is a very solitary activity.
Yeah. And on that particular thing, I feel very similar in that I'm not very good at being instructed and I'm not very good at, you know, pumping iron and all that sort of stuff. So the things I go to, the yoga and the martial arts, there is someone who leads the group and they are thought of as kind of helping you along rather than yelling at you and telling you to go for the burn and stuff like that. And that's been really good. Mm. And the last yoga thing I went to, I was pretty terrible, but I felt that the instructor was helping me and I was actually getting something out of it. So I felt pretty good about that. I think there's a different style, really. There's the guy yelling at you and there's the let's help the whole class kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's a I've got two subtopics and then we'll go back up to my second follow-on topic. So it's the first subtopic is... Oh, I've got an outline here with my iPad Pro and Apple Pencil.
Good.
Well, it's sort of an outline. I'm trying to keep track. Are you still using the GoodNotes app? What was your opinion?
Oh, yeah. I like it. I still like the I really do like the idea of having lots of different sorts of things on one page. I think it looks nice.
It is nice. It's really nice to go back in GoodNotes to the they don't call it a light box view, but the zoomed out to see all your pages. Yeah. And it's a nice feeling of accomplishment when you see sort of like a lot of diversity in your content. Or conversely, it's another source in my life where I feel like I'm not doing enough, but that's fine.
Yes.
That's fine. I think that's a positive momentum. So here was my little items. This one, another curious thought exercise is, let's say I was with some sort of personal trainer or like yoga instructor, like how would I identify and know that they were friendly and trying to help? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like maybe if I thought they were friendly and trying to help, then I wouldn't be so nervous about it. But like, that's, I'm not sure what to, I mean, would I be able to spot that? I'm trying to think, like, I can spot outside of that activity context, like people that I know really well. But like, man, you would have to be, as you're saying, comfortable, like doing martial arts. Like you would have to identify, like, this person is here to help me, even though I'm but learning how to beat people up. Right.
Yeah. I think there's a pretty reasonable way of doing that, because what you're describing is how can I identify that there isn't going to be something negative in this relationship with this person in the kind of 6 months I'm going to know them at least. And the answer to these kind of things with all of these little groups is they almost always give you like a weak taster session. So for example, this yoga thing I went along to, I quickly found their idea of beginner isn't really beginner. It kind of assumes quite a lot of knowledge, and they have a bit of the kind of esoteric kind of namaste kind of stuff, which I'm not particularly into, but it's bearable for me. So I felt like, if I was going to go and learn swimming, I can't swim. I get the idea that if I spend a week with someone and you have that kind of cutoff period where you can say, well, I tried a weak taster and it's not for me. And I think particularly with exercise, after a week, you could pretty well judge, am I going to be okay white collar boxing or whatever it is you've signed up for?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Okay. No. Yeah. That's all right. I'm going to drop my other topic because it's too lengthy, but then I'm going to go back to my second follow-up question. So yoga pants, what's going on there?
I'm trying not. Apparently, and I saw this, I think in Apple News or something, that yoga pants now outsell denim.
Heresy. Or is it heresy? That's crazy.
Yeah,
it's heresy.
I'm not wearing yoga pants at the moment. I am not wearing yoga pants.
So what are the men in the yoga wear? Do they also wear the tight pants?
I don't. No, not after 40. No one's.
How about the other one? There must be at least one other man in there, or someone who identifies as male.
Yes. There is at least one other man, and I have seen a man wearing quite tight trouser objects. But no. I'm keeping everything loose and accommodating down there.
That would be when perhaps you and I, but when a clothing store for geeks finally opens up, there'll be a section called trouser objects.
Trouser dot objects. Yes.
No. Let me just, and then we'll wrap this topic up, and we can go back to cloud lock-in if you want But one of the items coincidentally that I wrote on the topic. One of the items I wrote down on the topic blast was, men used to wear yoga pants in Shakespearean days, right? And I don't know if that's just depictions that I've seen, but I feel like, and you see it in pictures, like of your friend Henry VIII, all the men used to wear tights. And so, I don't know what kind of cycle that we're on, but I feel like we're on the other side of wearing yoga pants. It's gone to the other gender. And
that
but it
is
used
a
to be,
good point.
Let's see, what Henry was in the early 1500s, is that right? So
contemporaneous with, yes.
Yes, a contemporaneous. There you go. so we're talking 500 years ago. It's a 500-year cycle that we go through, I think, because that obviously was the height of men wearing yoga pants.
Yeah, don't hold your breath. It's coming back 300 years.
Yeah, in the Star Trek timeline, it'll be there. Yeah. Well, so the cloud lock-in, it's very complicated. I mean,
that's not the answer I was looking for.
I think the answer is there's two ways to answer the question. One of them is as a vendor whose product you are not buying, right? And so if I was Amazon, I would tell you why it's not cloud lock-in, or why it's an incredible advantage that you get, or I might say something like, well, you're locked into Linux and you're locked into your programming language. And so you're just choosing your layer of lock-in, right? Or you might say something like, Another popular thing is to say, well, there's only 5 methods in this API. And so really, how locked in can you be, right?
Okay.
And so you could do that. And you know, I personally, and then I'll get to the vendor thing, like I would sort of argue, I would kind of go that simplicity thing, right? Like I remember back when I still knew programming, what I thought was interesting about the whole REST phenomena, and I don't know if this was, you know, some people would state it like, well, remember the micro format person in that Chris Messina, like they were they had interesting philosophies of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they would simplify REST programming so that it wasn't even programming, which is kind of a testament to that. But I feel like there was an idea scurrying around there, and your contemporary, Dave Weiner, I think would also be one of these people, which was like, you should just make things really simple. Right. Like, yes. And so if it's really simple, then a lot of the things you're worrying about don't matter. Right. So like when you look at a REST API call, like it should say like picture, what do you do with the picture? You upload a picture. You don't really need to write a document for that. Right. Like if I say picture, the picture call has file type, what do you think the file type might mean? Like, all of that kind of stuff. So then, of course, you get in the situation where like, well, what if there's 50 attributes and all this kind of stuff? I mean, eventually you end up with like WS star again. It's just like you're using tabs instead of greater than less than signs or whatever, which is fine. And so I don't know. I mean, I think as long as you keep things really simple, then you're just talking about a bulk of things to move over, right? So if you had 5 Lambda things, I don't really even know what it looks like, so maybe I'm making this up, but let's say you have 5 Lambda calls and then you want to move it to Spring Function as a Service or IBM Whisk or something, then you've only got 5 things to deal with. Yeah. But if you've got like 3,000, then you're fucked, right?
Yeah.
like you can't really, it's just, I don't know. How complicated is the Lambda stuff?
Well, I mean, it's at the moment, I mean, it's, my feeling about it is, it's kind of amazing. And I feel the same about the Azure Function stuff and stuff like, what's the pivotal thing? Riff, things like that.
Riff. Where
I thought they're all comparable, but the last thing I looked at was Lambda, and I had a look at Lambda when it first came out and it felt a bit kind of thin, but I had a look at it recently and it was really, really impressive, but it gave me that feeling of, oh, wait a minute, these people run everything. So it was really, oh, right. I've got an idea for a thing I would like to run at a URL. So I'd like this to run as a URL. I'd like to pass a string into it and get a response back or something like that. So you open up this little text area, you type in a little bit of Python or Go or Node, and you save it, and they have these templates where everything is done for you. It sets up, you know, it points to a GitHub repository, it does the continuous delivery stuff, it does monitoring, and I tried it out, and at the end of the month I get my bill and it's 70 cents and I'm thinking, my God, they're doing the whole lot. I don't even have an IDE outside of a browser, and it works. And there's constant offers along that basic pipeline of, oh, do you want a domain name? Well, you can buy a domain name for us. Oh, do you want monitoring? Oh, you can buy some more monitoring from us. It's very, very clever. I mean, it's the work that they've done there is very, very impressive, as well as Azure. And they keep kind of leapfrogging each other, but it just made me feel a bit odd. But I get your point, particularly about where in the whole stack you're locked in, because you could say of any organization, hey, do you use Office or do you use Google Docs? Because, you know, if you're using SharePoint and you want to change out SharePoint, if you want to move your intranet from SharePoint to something that's not SharePoint next year.
I didn't think of that angle. I mean, that's certainly true. Like, I'm sure you recall with diminishing relish the whole OpenOffice, like,
Oh yeah, yeah.
From
yeah,
you know, like yeah. when when Berlin was like, we are going to use, I'm not going to insult Germans by making an accent, but they were like, we're not going to use Microsoft. We're not going to use Yankee Office. We're going to use the Open Office.
Yes.
And I remember a couple years ago, I saw that they got a Office 365 subscription there in Berlin.
Yes.
So yeah, good for them. But, you know, I mean, yeah, sure. It's sort of like, you know, if you use the Mac OS with case sensitive journaling, you're locked into that when you want to plug it into a, let's say you might be in an executive briefing center and you have a USB drive that you want to plug into a computer so you can show your presentation to some fancy customers. And you've Mac OS journaled it with case sensitive file system instead of FAT32. And that's some fun lock in.
Yeah. Well, you've got a nice new USB key with USB-C. Everyone looks at you, says, "No, you can't plug that in anywhere."
Oh, USB-C. I mean, really, is there any physical reason why the plug format has to change? I mean, are there more wires in there or something? Like, it just seems like.
I've got a theory about this. Is that as the sort of improvements get quicker, so going from like A to C, the swap over time is pushed more towards the consumer and less towards the producer. Mm. So the producer kind of decides, right, USB-C, what a great idea. New format, great idea. We're going to solve all these problems, plug them in. And then the sort of lag time is longer and longer and longer and longer. I mean, when's the last time you're going to see a laptop out in the wild with USB-A? I mean, it's going to be years and years and years.
Yeah.
I mean, there are obviously new plugs after USB-C, but it's not fun. It's not fun. I'm not a big fan.
I mean, if they continue this clever naming scheme, I guess it'll be USB-D.
USB-D.
That's my prediction for the next decade. USB-D.
You shouldn't give.
Yeah,
these
so you know, I mean, I think maybe
ideas away. So like...
Yeah, exactly. I think you know. I think again. I am not an expert in like actual technology nowadays, but it does seem like the real lock in you have to any technology is all the other stuff around it, right? Like, how do you combine together all this stuff into an actual application that you do something with, right? Like, you know, you mentioned the monitoring and whatever. I mean, whatever other stuff you have, like that, that's where you get lock-in. And it's not by virtue of any sort of, I mean, I think the way that at least the last 20 years we thought of lock-in, wait, is that not far enough back? What would that be? 1998? Did I do that math right? I think what was influenced by Unix, and Windows, right?
Yeah.
And so, like Unix, and I don't really remember this, but there was a certain lock-in type of Unix, right?
Yeah.
Because you wanted to go to Linux because Linux was if not free, much cheaper, and so everyone wanted to. I'm sure maybe not everyone. They all wanted to move their stuff from Solaris, AIX. Whatever that one Linux was that was suing everyone and whatever. And like, yeah, there you go. And like, they probably all had just like any Linux distribution, they probably had slightly different file systems and they might have different like method calls that you had to write in C. So it turned out that maybe this licensing fee that you had was not going to be cheaper because you have to pay all this money and take on all this risk to like rewrite and recompile your C software.
Yes.
Like no one wants to deal with make files.
Yeah.
So everyone was like, oh my God, lock-in is terrible. And then of course there was Windows. And the issue with Windows was just like, we would also like to move our stuff to Linux, or we would like to more easily make a web version. And for some reason it's not easy in Windows. And it is easy in Windows, but I have to pay Microsoft to update to the new thing. And so like all this lock-in stuff is often built, is often driven by there's a cheaper option that I would like to move my stuff to. Now,
yes.
I think just before I forget it, I think there's a second one, which I think is a lesser one. And it is there is a better technology, regardless of the cost, I would like to use the better technology.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that might be an instance, like mobile stuff kind of is an instance of that, potentially, where like I need a Android or iOS native application. But currently I have a web application and I'm locked into the web application, right? And I would like to somehow be able to move my application over or have a view into it or something. And in that context, I'll think about lock-in as how difficult and costly is my current technology yes. going to make moving, right?
Yeah. And
versus,
by the costs.
Yeah. And if, for example, you were a dyed-in-the-wool Microsoft person, you might not even think about lock-in because you would be like, I can do that. What I saw in that keynote where I have a ASP yeah, application yeah. and I just yeah. drag it to this side of the screen and now I have a mobile application, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. you might be Power like, there's no lock-in. Awesome. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But it is like, I mean, that's, I think that wanting to go somewhere cheaper is often the cause of people being upset about lock-in because of course, I'm sure many of the people who went to Unix were like, I got to get off of this mainframe because I am locked into the mainframe. Right.
Yeah.
And so it is like, lock-in's a very elusive sort of thing. And, but I think it is worthwhile focusing on like that second one of like, if I wanted to use a new technology, how easy would it be to use that new technology? And I think what's often missed, what makes me talk so much about this and makes it such a fraught issue and also an issue, I haven't ever gotten to the third thing, an issue that's very effective for vendors to market around is there really is no widely understood heuristic for figuring out lock-in. Right. There's no way to say, like, I don't know, maybe he has, but I don't think there's a Martin Fowler Blicky entry on like defining lock-in. There's probably more studying about tech debt than there is about defining lock-in.
Yeah. I mean, it does make me, thinking about it. I mean, it's, say, for example, Rotterdam Council, I'm going to Rotterdam this week, and Rotterdam Council might have a big investment in Office 365. And then they have separately from that, they have all of their, as it were, business systems logic written in something else. And they might well think to themselves about business systems being where the lock-in is, rather than looking at all of their documentation they've got in SharePoint or Google Docs or whatever they've got it in. So it might weirdly be easier to move the business logic than it is to move every single piece of documentation and your HR and whatever. And that this is something I've been thinking about a lot this recently, only because I've been compelled to, about that idea between, as it were, external public facing data, you know, the stuff we do and sell, and the internal private data being HR and identity management, that sort of stuff, and how quickly that internal data management is moving. So we are getting to the stage where the HR system vendor is saying, well, we don't actually sell a desktop app anymore. It is all through the web anyway. So things are moving quicker in the internal data than I think a lot of organizations are really happy to deal with. And particularly, I mean, thinking particularly of iOS devices, which is where I see this a lot, every Friday or something, Outlook says it's updating, and it has a wonderful little description of itself in the release notes and on the phone saying, keep your updates updated. Here is 100 meg of new Outlook. Good luck. And I think to myself, well, where does the, as it were, the old fashioned IT department come into all this? No, the vendors are now rolling out updates to software by the day to user audiences around companies. And it's kind of the software is rushing through the legs of the gatekeepers inside the companies. So it's almost got to a stage where you don't even see whether lock-in is happening or not. So for example, if you're using Microsoft Office and someone comes up to you and says, oh, have you used Sway or Microsoft Flow? There are going to be people in the IT function in any organization who say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Microsoft Flow is a really good example because it's basically Microsoft's equivalent to IFTTT. And it looks really, really crap, but it looks slightly less crap every week. And it is part of Office. So, you know, Microsoft are deploying it onto your systems, into your, you know, user audience, whether you really know it or not. I don't think there's a really, there isn't much of a kind of corporate gatekeeping with these systems like there used to be, because you used to buy a DVD or a CD and install it on the boxes or not. And now, you know, if you can log in with your Microsoft account or your Google account, it's kosher. It runs. Microsoft Flow is deeply strange.
Yeah, they do always do a strange job of consumer grade things. I mean, that's not even the right way to put. Well, for one thing, their consumer stuff is always weird. There's except for Xbox, but that's the exception that proves the rule. And but then too, like they're oddly enough, although I guess there's lots of criticisms of Office of being too featureful or whatever, but I think as the most recent two duplicators of, not duplicators, I'm giving away the punchline, as the most recent people who have attempted to solve that job to be done have shown, that being Keynote and Google Docs, you actually do need all that mess. So,
yes,
you know, whatever. That was a dumb analogy. I was going to talk about ground beef, but that doesn't work. But you... So, I mean, not to get too thought lordy, right? But you know, one of the things I struggle with a lot, it sort of is part of my job speaking at vendors is, and I don't really think of it this way, but is to really go in and be like, what is IT? Like, what are computers, and how does your business, your organization relate to them, and how do you think about them, and like, how do you think about them with respect to what you do every day? And what you're supposed to be doing every year. And then how do you not think about it? And like, and I mean, like I said, I wouldn't even think of like documents and things like that, but that's you know, like you were telling me a story of how all these, like speaking of men in tights, all these tax records used to just be lying around crumbling.
Yeah.
And you know, they lit on fire at some point. And like, you know, you're sort of locked into these tax records, right? Like you have this paper and there were, I mean, back in the open doc days, there was a little bit of thinking about this of like, we need an open document format because we need to be able to access this stuff, which is kind of a crude answer to what I was saying. But then they were like, and then so we, therefore we have open document, which is like a zip file of like 50 files all in XML. It's just like, I don't think you've solved the problem there.
Yeah.
Right. And it's almost like, and this is a, just is more of a thought exercise, because I don't think it's the right answer, but it's sort of like, well, if what you really care about is the readability of these documents, the eternal access to them. I mean, this, let's assume there's electricity and we have a way, we have file systems, and just like, we're going to have to assume that. In the same way that if we were to write everything on clay tablets, we assume people will know how to read them, right? So that's your level of lock. And anyways, like logically, you would use plain text files, right? Like you would basically, and this is what I mean by like saying how people relate to IT, you would somehow get it through people's heads that all of the formatting that you do on a document that necessitates it not being plain text is actually a bad idea and not worth all that formatting. And yet people will be like, but I got to make this thing bold.
Yeah.
Right. Like they couldn't cope with like text. And so like, it's like, I think that's like a representation of this fundamental thing of like, you don't think about IT. I don't know. Like what you want is not compatible with how you're thinking about IT.
I think you're right in describing that as not a very good answer, but it is a very good question. That idea of, okay, what are we what do you want to do here? I mean, how do you want to relate to all this machinery in the future? I mean, are you okay with what you're doing this month? And do you want to still be doing that? You know, do you still want to be doing this job 10 years from now? Mm. What you said actually just reminded me of, and of course I've forgotten the podcast I was listening to, about preserving information for long periods of time. And there was a thing called Rosetta Disk. And have you heard of this, the Rosetta Disk idea?
Mm-mm. No.
It's such a mad idea. And it was so weird when I first saw it. And when it was explained to me, it really made sense. So this idea of preserving languages. So the idea is you would write down, you know, the first three chapters of the Declaration of Human Rights in like 600 languages and store it. So 1,000 years from now, people will be able to look at the languages and compare them and be able to reconstruct all the languages that we speak now that would die off in 2,000 or 3,000 years. So I thought that's a great idea. But obviously they run into this idea of, well, okay, what medium do you inscribe this information on that is going to be readable 1,000 years from now or 2,000 or 3,000 or 10,000? And they came up with a really good idea. They just inscribed it on some glass or something in really, really small text, because the idea was, well, optical magnification is a technology that has been around for a very long time, and it's reasonable to assume it will still be available in the future. In fact, it's reasonable to assume it'll actually get better. So all they did was just write really small.
Are you still there?
I am.
Oh, okay. Perfect. I was on mute, but I said like microfish. I mean, right? That's what they are, right? Like you reduce down big pieces of paper to an optical medium, and it's much smaller.
Yeah, exactly so. And I many years ago when I used to work in newspapers, that's what we used to do. We used to have to go to the archives and sit there at those massive machines whirring through. What was it? There was microfiche and microfilm. Microfilm was those little, it looked like a cassette, but microfiche was like celluloid-y A2 size sheets, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm sure we could look this up on the internet, but I think, yeah, microfiche, as they say, are like sheets. Whereas, yeah, you could also have those tapes of things that you.
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it is a bit far afield from like serverless, but I think it is that point of like people, you have to think about like what the point of this stuff is.
Yes.
Another angle on the lock-in thing, I think, comes from like, there's another way that a contemporary way of thinking about it in sort of like microservices folklore and microservices folklore. One of the things is that it's a small method, and there's the, I forget who it was. I think is some Australian or English person. And the way they would joke about it was like, I always say, people ask me how big a microservice should be. And I say the code should be about as tall as your head, you know, on a 24-inch monitor or something like that, right? I mean,
okay,
you know,
yeah.
It's just like a two-pizza team. You could be like, well, how big are the pizzas? Whatever, without overthinking it. And so the thinking there is that this microservice is so small that it's almost impossible for there to be any type of lock-in, because you could just look at it and understand how it works, and equally, you could rewrite it quickly to be whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
Which is describing lock-in at the code level, right? Like,
yes.
I'm sure you have seen code that is locked into itself. Like, for example, when I was working on some software, you know, this is back when you had, what was it called? When you map your code to a relational database, whatever the word for that is.
Object relational mapping.
Yes. Object relational mapping. That was ORM. I remember I was in the elevator once with the one of the main people who had written Hibernate, and I remember thinking at the time Hibernate was just like, well, It was magical because we didn't want to pay for the closed source thing that actually TopLink that did the same thing.
And, oh yes,
which is interesting. So the code locked into itself. I remember I was using some code that was doing your ORM, and it must have been like 20 to 300 heads tall, so to speak, right?
Oh,
and
boy.
And it had other class files that it would access, you know, up and down the inheritance tree. And it's sort of like, I mean, I guess one might call that tech debt instead of lock-in, but it was like this type of lock-in at the code level that, like, it was just impossible. So
yeah, there's also been recent arguments, and with which I broadly agree, that things like jQuery and Rails are a sort of lock-in.
Right.
So people think of themselves as a Rails programmer rather than a Ruby programmer.
And that's what I was made. Well, that's maybe related to what I was angling at with the head microservice. Head microservice is as big as your head, is, as you were talking about, and this goes full circle back to what you're saying, is like, well, the huge assumption that you have is all that you care about is that head height chunk of code.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas in reality, you potentially care about all the way down through the through your orchestration stuff, to your operating system, to your server, to your networking, to the data center, to the cooling, to the dirt, right? Like, you could potentially care about all of this stuff. Yeah. And like, it's not just like you change this code around, right? Like, I mean, it's just different little pods of lock-in that you have, which again is not to all of this may sound like, is the word dissembling? I always need to go look that up. But like, I'm trying to avoid I'm just trying to muddy up what lock-in is to avoid it. But it's just like, I mean, lock-in is always a more complicated question than just like the way that I think most people talk about it is, again, either I want to move to a cheaper way of doing something, or the way that it, in my world, the way that it's often deployed is like, oh, that's not open source. As if like there's no lock-in in open source, right?
Yeah,
which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I don't know.
Well, yeah, one oddity about pseudo lock-in in open source is I have often used open source languages and systems, which are still open, yet so few other people use them, they might as well not exist.
Mm.
So things like Factor or Rebel, Redlang, as it is now, Faro, the Smalltalk environment. I mean, they're all open source, but they've got such a small number of people using them that if two people get a flu, then I'm on my own, really. I might as well be using Excel macros.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, which I mean, somewhat related to that, it goes back to the what do you want to do with IT, and it would almost, I mean, it's kind of like an Excel macro. It's sort of like, so if you were to look at, if you went there to the to Rotterdam to talk to the Dutch people, and you were like, you know what you should do? There's two things. One, you should use serverless, and then never mind if this is the right level to use that kind of vocabulary, but like, the reason you should use that is you should have a new way of thinking about things where every week you just like write some new code, and it's almost like disposable code that you're not going to need for a long time. So like, just like every 2 weeks you have the big meeting that you have to work on a PowerPoint for, and then the PowerPoint after the meeting rapidly loses its value. It gets emailed around to a few people, and those people make a decision based on what's in the PowerPoint. And once that decision is done, no one cares anymore. Right. Like, just to say something painfully out loud, I think pretty much every presentation that I no longer use, I spent a huge amount, like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars spread across all the people who worked on them. And their value plummeted even more than buying a new car when you drive it off the lot, right? So like,
depreciation.
There is no value. That's right. There's no value to a PowerPoint presentation once execution is done. There's value for lawsuits, but that's a liability, in fact. So there's negative value. but you know, similarly, you could think of code that way, of like, the way that you've orchestrated whatever it is you're doing, once you execute this, you don't give a fuck about it. So who cares about lock-in, right? Like, you should, I don't know. Maybe that's not quite correct, because it's the problem with government stuff is like, you're going to have 50 to 300 years of having to provide health insurance to people, right? Like, or not even insurance, but care, right? Like, you're always going to need to pay government employees. So, like, maybe you should think about it in a more permanent way than.
But there's also those, you know, being very po-faced about it, there's also the additional pressure of, hey, we're using public money here. So maybe we should be looking at these things a bit more closely.
Yeah. Yeah. Government IT is really strange. It's we don't have a lot of good tools.
Nothing to say.
which is ironic because I find that, well, I mean, it's because I don't read other languages than English, but I think the sort of like British government IT community is like the only active community out there, like thought-wise.
Yeah.
Really, like there's every day there's a tremendous amount of stuff written about like government IT from the council level all the way up to the queendom level, national. Man, there's a lot of stuff out there and it's all generally pretty good versus like, we've got like the 18F blog here in the US and I think the Australians write about stuff every now and then, but the British, they're just writing stuff like there's no tomorrow.
Oh, they're mad for it. Absolutely love it. Can't get enough.
They're mad for it. They're mad for government IT philosophy.
Yeah, they actually are.
Well, you know, something I've been dying to say related to all of this is it is impossible to get all of your photos out of Flickr. It is just like there is no way to do it. And that is a platform born in the crucible of openness. And it is just like it just is impossible.
I tried. And I knew a couple of people and I tried myself to write things, even using the API to hoover stuff back off. But I stopped trying. I just stopped trying. I just walked away. And now my method is to do a kind of Syracuse and have my photos in several different places. And I've just given up.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. I mean, something like Google Photos. Google Photos is great. And I'm reasonably sure that there's a way, you know, Google Takeout or whatever it's called, of getting information back out. But what the hell am I going to do? It's like, you know, I don't know, at half a terabyte of zip files. I mean, I can't do anything with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good example of what they call data gravity or data gravity. I don't know how to say that word. And but it also has some stupid attached to it, right? Like, or I shouldn't say stupid. I mean, I would say that, but if I was not being me, it's yet another instance of you can tell the team who wrote the ability to export your photos actually is not that big of a user of the software in the following way, right? Where like, I remember when Flickr did this, they were like, oh, now you can batch export your photos, which sounded awesome. And then if you're like me and perhaps you, and you've been using Flickr since, I don't know, 2004, 2002. Yeah. I don't know how long it is. And you have, like you said, half a terabyte of photos in there. First, the way that you bulk export is you can like download a gallery or something. Yeah, but anyways, to cut a long story short, you can only download 500 photos at once, sort of. And so that would be fine, sort of, if they had a workflow that, you know, if they had a user story that was like, user would like to download their 10 years of photos and be able to spend 5 minutes doing it and not have to think about it ever again, right? So it would almost be like reversing the flow of the Flickr uploader. They need a Flickr downloader that's just like, I just want to download all my photos. I don't know what that means. So in contrast, I have tried two different external applications and there is no, they don't like keep track of what you've downloaded already. And they don't like just kind of passively download the things for you and all of that stuff.
Yeah. So, you have to sit there and gardening. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like every time that I've been somewhere that has like an 80 megabits per second, a really fast internet connection, I get a little excited because I'm like, oh, now I'm going to download all my Flickr photos. And then I realized, like, oh, this is a stateless process, so I have no idea what's going on.
I have noticed that with Google Photos. So Google Photos on iOS devices will start syncing when it gets reasonable Wi-Fi. And where I live, it considers, yeah, that's not really good Wi-Fi. So it just sits there, even though I'm in my own home looking at this thing. We've got Wi-Fi. I mean, I'm on it right now, but it's not good enough for Google. And the thing I kind of wanted was, again, thinking about the kind of level three-ness of the internet, was Smug Mug, or whoever's, you know, going on to Flickr now, to be able to say to me or whoever, hey, you've got a Flickr account. We've shifted everything over, and it's all here.
That would be fine.
They're probably in the same building, for goodness sake. And what? They've got hundreds of thousands of people downloading individual JPEGs and uploading them again? Sounds madness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things, maybe you've already tried this and it doesn't work, but like, this seems like it would be a good serverless thing. Is you write, it's just a script, right? It's only a script. So you write your little script that attaches to your, I don't know if this is an S3 bucket or a Dynamo. It could probably be S3 because it's single user, single threaded or whatever. And basically, because all I want is like, I don't want to have to download it to my laptop, right? Like I want it to be in the cloud and go to Google Photos and just give Google Photos some OAuth bullshit to go to Flickr and just download it all for me, right? And I feel like this is maybe even yet another instance of these people don't actually use it. Or maybe I'm in this 1% minority, but I feel like the power users, this is a very, as you say, Syracusean thing, like the power users of Google Photos probably all have Flickr accounts and they are in this exact same problem, right? Yep. And so Google is my understanding are smart people. And so the product manager or managers of Google Photos might be like, oh, these people have a lot of their stuff in Flickr and probably would be willing to pay us right now, if not at some point. So we should just write a thing that just sucks all your Flickr stuff and like we're Google, so it'll be fast or whatever. Right. Yeah. And like, that would be the idea, go on Google Photos and just give it my credentials and it does it for me. Or it seems like you could also just write some script that used the Flickr API, and I presume there's a Google Photos API, I don't know, and it just transmit those things for you. And then you would have to pay for network transit and stuff like that. But still, like, it's just baffling that it's difficult to do that. And maybe it's something where, like, Flickr's like, how about not?
Yeah.
But
I'll forget it. This is this is, I think, where Zapier makes money.
Because the
reason I don't want to trust IFTTT is, of course, there's no price. Zapier, I don't want to pay the price, but at least I know where the money's going and they're actually making some money. I think this is exactly what Zapier do. They do all that kind of crap in the background, but it's worth $20.
That might be useful. I've probably seen other examples. Oh, yeah. I've probably seen other examples of what I was describing out there, but the most recent one that sticks in my mind is, you know, where we host this podcast, and the other one's this fireside.fm, which is great, right? That's a good example of a software written by some people who use it. And so it has, which is the main reason I went to go use it, because it's written by, or it's headed up by someone who does a lot of podcasts. And so it has podcast-friendly stuff. Anyways, they have a great import feature where you just point it to your RSS feed and it just imports everything. And it does it pretty well. Like, it not only gets the MP3 file, but it also copies the title and the text, if I remember. And, it does exactly what you would expect it to, which is, it
feels like it's been written by someone who's had to do that at least three times themselves previously.
Exactly. And that's all I'm asking. Like, for the photo sharing things, they should just figure that out.
Yeah.
going in between the various ones. That would be so nice. Well, do we have any other topics before we wrap up here?
I think we should wrap up. I've got to say, not being on Skype has been a revelation. I mean, it's just,
Yeah, it is. It is pretty good. We're using. Oh yeah, we're using Zoom, which I think is pretty good. Well, Zoom, which
I'd never heard of apart from as a joke, but now here we are. Yeah.
It is a bit jingoistic because their domain name is zoom.us, which I guess they mean it to be us, like Zoom us. Does anyone really think that? Like, we all know this is just more imperialism. As we take over the world.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Well, let me, you know, I think we had a whole episode of Computer Corner. Let me just read our topic blast for the week.
Yes.
Because I think we put a lot of, it's fun. We put a lot of effort into this. And maybe next time we'll go through it. So here's our topic blast or glacier. What do you call it? Glacier. What does that mean? Because it's just the tip?
No, it's just the opposite of a blast. Cold moves slowly.
I see. Now that makes sense. I didn't think of blast as being like a fast moving thing. I was thinking more of like, I always think of blast as sort of like a spread out explosion, not something that's fast. I mean, obviously an explosion is fast, but I think of it as a sort of like that scene in whichever Monty Python movie where the person blows up and he splatters everywhere. That's what I think of as a blast.
Mr. Creosote.
Mr. Creosote. Wafer Thin Mint.
Yes, Wafer Thin Mint.
Okay, here we go. Okay. Our glacial topic blast. Mm-hmm. So first of all, being a man or being in a man place. And I was in a barbershop recently that was just like it was a man place. And I was thinking like, oh, I'm not really in a man place. And it wasn't a man place like, you know, like there's a bunch of playboys and like chauvinistic. It was just like a man place. And it was an interesting feeling I hadn't had for a while. Now, we already talked about FTP versus AWS, so that's fine. Yeah. And who's TC Curry? What's that?
I think it was someone on a Newstack podcast.
Mm.
A female person talking to Bridget Cromhout.
I haven't listened to that one. There's no such thing as a static environment.
Yeah. Hmm. But that really stuck in my mind. I mean, the whole thing was pretty good, but there's no such thing as a static environment.
Mm. And then of course you mentioned Rotterdam. Maybe we'll catch up on that next week. I've heard Rotterdam is a very nice town and slightly cheaper than Amsterdam.
Oh, cool.
Which sounds good. And then I was wondering earlier. I started listening to yet another American politics book called Chasing Hillary. You can look that up if you really care. And I was thinking like, what are methods that journalists use to keep daily notebooks? Because that seems like something I would be really into at least reading about and perhaps not doing. But it's something beyond the whole like, you know, life hacks, Merlin Mann thing. Like, I feel like the journalists have been around for a while. So they do in journalism school, do you like learn something, right?
Yes.
And I'm figuring there's a template that's like at the end of every day, here are the five topics you should dump your brain about because these are the things that you're going to need in the future. So the next one, I found that I went back and read this, and I think this is some piece that I'll go back and reread every now and then when I'm down in the dumps, which is a phrase I think you and I should bring back to society. Down in the dumps. That's good. but you know, there's this guy on one of my exegesis podcasts that Brandon and I, he wrote this book called The Four. And man, I feel bad because I really did not like, I feel like to invoke him again, I was taking a mean Syracusean critique, which was, does this book accomplish what it set out to do? And I think it did not. And it was a big missed opportunity that frustrated me because I was very excited about this book. But anyways, there's this guy, Scott Galloway, who he's got a lot going on. His company was acquired by Gartner and he like is a big CrossFit person. And he's almost like, I would call him the man version of Mary Meeker, if that's not an obscure enough reference.
No anyways, idea.
He had this... he had this post called, he does these weekly posts that are the things I would aspire to do. It's a mixture of like personal life and like for his world, he's in the consumer, online consumer brand shit area.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, he mixes together normal life and consumer brand stuff. And it's called Happiness and the Gorilla. And he's got this, it's just a long post about how to think about your life. And I remember one that I read, this is a very long, long layup to this. But the quote says, the number one piece of advice seniors would give to the younger selves is they wish they'd been less hard on themselves, which there's a lot going on there. That seems pretty good.
Yeah.
And then the next topic, I started reading It. So I've never really read a Stephen King book. And it's made me think of writers who write writers in their written work. So there's a lot of writers who have authors as characters in their books. And I don't know how I feel about that. My first reaction is, I think that's very lazy. That should not be done. But I don't know. I think I need to. Well, you know, like you got The Sun Also Rises. The main character is a journalist. And you've got It. And one of the characters is a journalist. You've got Misery. I feel like there are a lot of important and unimportant books where the main character or an important character is a writer. And it is, that's a, I mean, I know you're supposed to write what you know, but that's a little too close.
Like painters always doing paintings of painters.
Exactly. Just like that Van Gogh guy. Can he find something else to paint except his bedroom and his head? Anyways. And then, so this is one of my broader topics, which is, I was having a conversation recently and I was told that my day-to-day life of thinking that life disaster is just around the corner must be stressful instead of motivating. And it reminded me.
I like how someone would tell you that.
And speaking of that Chasing Hillary book, there's a quote that I read that I think kind of feeds into this, which is she says, she was saying how one of her editors that she was really important to her would pass by and like make this clawing motion because he wanted to remind her that she was a polar bear and that was encouraging for her. But then she said, but polar bears are also lonely and endangered. I was floating on my own little iceberg and it was melting fast, which I think is basically that catastrophizing. So, and then I put this topic in, I mean, you know, shaving. There's that. So then my next topic was, you see why I like these? I could do a podcast that was just topic blasts. These are so, so exciting. I was on a flight over to Asia and we were landing in Hong Kong and I knew I had 40 minutes left and I didn't want to do anything. So they had the original Blade Runner. So I was watching it and you know, you may or may not remember the opening of Blade Runner. It starts with this weird Vangelis music. Vangelis or whatever. And then it sort of like opens up and there's this LA future where there's just like puffs of flame going up in the air and it's almost synced with the music. And it made me realize that like, if you're the director of the film, like, I mean, you're bounded by time and money, but like, man, you just like control everything. Because I was imagining Ridley Scott was like, I want it to be dark. And you hear this first part of the music. And also I'm going to tell Vangelis that that first part is shit and it needs to rewrite it. And then when it opens up, when there's this puff of flame that goes out of there, I want it synced to the 32 seconds into there. And like all throughout the film, the director, every little moment is like, no, let's try that again. Or like, that's perfect.
Imagine driving mad.
Yeah. And so on the one hand, it's like to paraphrase, the dude, that sounds exhausting. I guess that's not a paraphrase. That's a direct quote, but it is. But then on the other hand, it's like, man, you controlled everything. It's crazy.
Yeah. Also, film directors have names. So can you imagine in about 1986 or whatever, I don't know, 76, I don't know at the time, someone saying, oh, I'm working with a new film director. Oh, who is it? Stanley Kubrick. It's like, you don't need to know anything else.
Exactly.
It's like, okay. I know what to do.
Yeah. So my next topic blast is that I don't think you can comment on truth using etymology as a tool. And I've noticed this a lot recently where people will do the, actually-ing or splaining or whatever, where they'll be like, that word, actually, the etymology means this. Like, I think I brought this up recently, a couple episodes back, is like, someone was telling me that sarcastic means, you know, ripping flesh, and therefore it's bad to be sarcastic. And it's like, that's fucking bullshit, right? Like, that's not how language works. But I mean, right. it's both very true and anyways, you can't, there's no fair winning an argument based on etymology. That's not cool. And then, you know, I should write a book. That would be a good idea. And then my final topic blast to end on a perhaps down in the dumps note is, well, I'll do it in reverse order. So it's the open face shit sandwich, which is, yeah, I spent a lot of time looking through photos, and I'm often reminded of the missed opportunity to be happy that I had in the past, and like how miserable I was, because I may be smiling and things might be happening, but I only remember, like, there's one that I remember all the time. And I think this may be when I realized this is like, the family and I went to Paris a couple years ago, and we were at the Eiffel Tower at night. And I remember that night I was just like, in my own way, just like livid and gritting my teeth and just trying to get along. And so I'll look at pictures of that and be like, what was I doing? Right? Like, it's like, no matter what was happening, like, the kids were going crazy, and like I was worried what people were, but whatever. Like, yes. It's just like crazy. I just screwed that up. Now, on the other hand, it's also fun to look at old pictures and be reminded of fun things. Like, I was all of my photos got uploaded recently, and I used to take lots of screenshots. I found some screenshots of when you used to tweet, which was like it was. Okay. I mean, not to have, as they say, faint praise. I'm not saying it's not necessarily that was happy, but it was sort of like, oh, that was a delightful like moment in history. Like, look at all these old screen. Like, I had lots of old screenshots of, like, you know, my old iPhone, and it's just
That thing to wrap it all up. That thing you said, missed opportunity to be happy. And number one piece of advice seniors would give to the younger selves, I think they go together.
Mm, they do.
And I had not thought about it in that way, a missed opportunity I had to be happy.
Because
always that feeling of, oh, I'm going to be happy later. I'm going to do this work and that's going to make me happy. Yeah. I'm going to spend this money and it's going to make...
Exactly. And I think the thing that kind of mental therapeutic advice... I don't know if they hold back or if I'm wrong or whatever, but there is some motivation and benefit from knowing when things went wrong, right? Like, like, I remember once you said you don't like think about or regret the past, which I'm sure was like, you know, at least 50-50 joking serious, or, you know, whatever. Maybe it was more like 90-10 or some Italian ratio, but like it is sort of like you do have to evaluate and dwell on. Dwell is a loaded word. You have to analyze the past in order to figure out what works and doesn't work, right? And so and I don't know what the, you know, like when you talk to a therapist, you learn never to use the word fine, because fine is like this trigger word of like, fine actually means I'm doing terribly. So you never want to say fine, because then that leads to this rat hole that you can't escape. So this is just remove, unless you're in the 80s and you're describing some person you have a crush on, you never use the word fine. Right. Yeah. And so similarly, I feel like regret might be one of these words, right? Like, you're not supposed to think in terms of regret, but I feel like that probably is a good motivation for figuring out like what to do. Not the only one, but like, because I looked at these old pictures of me being miserable in Paris, now I am very excited and interested in not being miserable.
Yes.
Right? Yes. So like, I don't know what that process is called, but like, that's the thing I don't want to lose by being sort of like using mental effervescence to be happy.
I feel like that
is a dangerous trap.
Thinking of things in terms of, instead of regret, thinking in things in terms of what effect did my actions have on other people and myself. Mm. And you think, well, okay, that's a sort of starting ingredient for something. That's not like, oh, I've done this terrible thing or I am this terrible person. But, well, okay, well, it turned out like that because of that. okay, so what opportunities do I have now to do things differently or not do the other things, those things at all? But the, oh yes, missed opportunity to be happy. I'm going to take that, especially to shows me how nuts I am. Going to Rotterdam tomorrow and just thinking of the traveling and the changing money and the passport and all that sort of stuff. And I'm thinking, God.
Oh yeah, you have to change money.
I'm going. Stop laughing. I'm supposed to be enjoying this. This is a luxury.
That was going to be one of my main topics having just come back from a week of traveling in Asia is I realized that one of the many epithets from my life will be I love this thing. I think it was from Emerson, and I must have read this in one place, and someone was making fun of him because he said that he was not very worldly because he had traveled extensively in Concord or whatever, and he said that in non-ironically, like, well, I've traveled extensively, 5 miles from my home.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have traveled extensively through my hotel window. Yeah. Lots of travel. Yeah.
Well, I will definitely make a note of, I'll try to remember what on earth happens in Rotterdam and tell you.
Well, maybe next episode, challenge, read Alan de Botton or whatever.
Yeah,
see if he can solve our problem.
Thinking
that guy. How do you say his name? You must know this person.
I'm not saying the name.
Thinking Hats. Isn't it?
Thinking Hats, Alan? The other guy, isn't he?
Yeah, that's he's De Bono. He's got quite a name. Alan De Bottom. De Bono and De Bottom. That would be great. They need to head talk. I think maybe De Bono's dead, but De Bono and De Bottom. That's what we're going to call this episode.
Oh,
De Bono. I'm going to say that one more time. De Bono and De Bottom. Oh, also just quick follow-up before we close out. Someone suggested a salad dressing for us. Very good salad dressing. I'll put the recipe in here.
Oh, yes,
I like to double the garlic and have the vinegar. And I think then that's perfect there. Maybe I'll go that right now. Well, if you want to get the show notes for this episode so you can figure out who De Bono and De Bottom is, if you just go to cashedout.coffee, I was going to say .com. I mean, go to cashedout.coffee/7, and there's the show notes. So next time, we're going to hear about how Rotterdam is fantastic. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. We'll see everyone next time.